So everybody along the line is an accomplice in this, all of whom disclaim responsibility. I think the medical community just keeps hoping we'll go away.
You're listening to The Brendan Marotta Show.
In this episode, I talked to Marilyn Milos and Georgianne Chapin, two names that should be very familiar to you if you've seen my documentary, American Circumcision. And side note, if you have not seen my documentary, American Circumcision, go immediately to circumcisionmovie.com and watch that now. But Marilyn Milos is the founder of NoCirc, which has now become Genital Autonomy America, which is now merging with Intact America, the organization that Georgianne Chapin runs. I'm not going to try to summarize this episode because we talk about too many things in it. We go through the history of the Intactivist movement, the movement against circumcision, all the way to the present, and talk about some of the challenges that their organizations are facing and what the future might hold. Now, here is Marilyn Milos and Georgianne Chapin. So I thought a good place to start, first of all, there's the big news of Intact America and NoCirc merging. We're going to talk about that. But I thought a good place to start might be how it is that the two of you met.
Oh, my.
Because obviously there's that meeting has led to some big things. But I'm curious when that first introduction happened.
Marilyn, you probably remember the year, and then we have our own versions of the story.
2003, I think.
Okay.
There I go.
So I'll tell from my perspective, and then I'll let Marilyn tell from her perspective. I started law school in 1999, and it was a 4-year evening program, and I knew it was going to lead to something, and I didn't know what. And I had been, I had been outspoken about the issue of circumcision for years before I went to law school. And then when right before I went to law school, my son had thanked me for not having him circumcised when he was born at the age in the year of 1980. So it was very much on my mind, and I was the head of a Medicaid managed care organization in New York's Hudson Valley, and that was a very big job. But I kind of, after 10 years of doing that, felt kind of like I had it, under control, and I decided to go to law school part-time at night. And when people asked me, what I was going to do with that law degree, I said, something's gonna happen. Something's going to come of it. So after the first, year maybe, I was taking all of these classes. I was taking human rights law, immigration law, refugee law, bioethics, and everything just kept screaming male genital cutting to me, circumcision. And I started just building this whole mental dossier of how completely obscene and absurd this practice was and how American it was. And so, as I went on, and I wrote a paper, I think in 2002, early 2002, a very long and very comprehensive paper, sort of the state of the issue at that time. It was a law paper with, as many footnotes as primary text. And I was talking to everybody I knew about it. And I did some internet work, and I found Doctors Opposing Circumcision, John Geisiker and George Denniston, and I found Stephen. And I saw NoCirc, and I decided to attend a meeting that was being held in D.C., in 2003, in probably, what was it, maybe February, March, Marilyn? And I went with a couple of my colleagues from the health plan. One was a physician and one was an attorney, and they're both friends of mine, in addition to we work together. And it was probably the most peculiar of all the Intactivist gatherings I have been in since, because it was in this horrible hotel, remember? I mean, I mean, horrible. Like you went in, you pulled into the parking lot and the metal doors closed behind you and you were just hoping that nobody would slither in before they closed. And it was really ratty. And we've had our gatherings in pretty nice places, but this place was, and so that's when I met Marilyn. She was at this event and a number of other people. Dan was there, Dan Bollinger, and Steven Svoboda, and John Geisiker, and that was
the year that the Soul baby was born. Remember?
Yes, William Soul. Right, William Soul was there. His wife or girlfriend was in labor in a room upstairs, and Marilyn kept ducking out of the meeting to go and attend to Amanda, right? I think it was her name. And it was just a wild event, a wild bunch of people. And I think Jeff Borg was there and everybody. And then I got what I thought was like this incredible honor. George Denniston at the last minute couldn't go, so he gave me his slot to talk. And I didn't go there to talk, but of course I'm going to talk. And so I talked about insurance, you know, coverage and Medicaid coverage for circumcision. And that's how I met Marilyn. And we just, I don't remember.
She came back to the next meeting, which blew my mind. I was thrilled to see her again. You know, just thrilled to see her again. And it's always been like that. I'm so glad. I don't think I could have picked anybody who could have done it better.
But nothing really significant, you know, happened in the relationship at that meeting. It was more just like, okay, you know, I'm in. This group is amazing. And I was sort of mystified, you know, why they were paying attention to me. But then, of course, I realized how, you know, having this supposedly mainstream healthcare executive there. I mean, I was a healthcare executive. I never considered myself terribly mainstream, but I brought something to the group. The movement has always been made up of people of varying expertise, right? I mean, there are filmmakers and there are writers and there are nurses and there are physicians and there are public relations people. And what?
An attorney.
Right. So, you know, so it was a very, and so I helped with that diversity. And anyway, that was how we met. I met a number of bunch of other people too. And it wasn't until 5 years later that we, or four and a half, 5 years later, that we actually started to solidify the forming of a new organization. And that Marilyn also was responsible for. Introducing me to Dean Pisani, who ended up funding Intact America. And that was another, but so I had been involved in going to symposia and communicating with all the parties in those 4 or 5 intervening years.
Dean Pisani called me, and he'd always been a supporter, and he kept saying, kept asking me, do you need more money? Do you need more money? But he was helping me go to the AAP every year. So we had a booth there at the American Academy of Pediatrics National Conventions. So Dean Pisani asked me what he wanted to do more. And then a couple of lawsuits came up. And so I got him connected with the lawyers involved, and he helped pay for those. So he did that. But then he still thought there's probably more he could do. And so I suggested to him that I would put together a conference call and invite the movers and the shakers in the movement so we could just talk about what needed to get done. And I invited Georgianne. To me, she was the most important person on that phone call. And I courted her for a while. I felt she was so good and so informed and so capable and so passionate and got the issue and was so clear about everything that she was the one. At that point, I was looking for somebody else. You know, I'm like, who's going to take over after? Because I'm getting older and older, and we could do this. And I felt really confident that she would be the one. So she joined us, and that's when. And then from there, we started having meetings, and Georgianne can tell you about those.
Yeah, what we did was in the first phone call, there were a lot of people, probably a dozen intactivists on the line, and people had ideas that were focused kind of on what they did. So, you know, the lawyers wanted money for lawsuits, and some people wanted money for PR, but it was still kind of narrow. The thinking wasn't big picture, you know. And so I had just set up a couple years earlier a nonprofit affiliated with the health plan, but a tech organization. It was tech and it was healthcare advocacy, sort of these two things. And I had used a social enterprise consulting firm, people who really took nonprofits and helped them to form more sophisticated business models that and more sophisticated business models than what they had formerly had. There are a lot of very sophisticated nonprofits. So I offered to re-engage this firm, and Dean offered to pay for it. And I, you know, came up with a budget, and, you know, it was more money in one place than most of the groups had, but it was necessary because we needed to put together a big picture futuristic organization. So they interviewed probably 20 leaders in the prominent people in the movement, and that there weren't probably but about 50, you know, at the time, right? So they interviewed, maybe there were 80, but really people who had been really speaking out and talking to each other. It was a pretty small group, and they interviewed everybody, and then we started meeting, and we met in Dean's company headquarters in Grapevine, Texas, just north of Dallas. And we had, I think, two meetings there with these consultants and talked strategy and vision, mission, gave the organization a name. That was
One of the things I thought was really interesting that the leaders of that group that were helping us talked about was that nonprofit organizations, after they start working as grassroots organizations, work together for a while. After 30 years, if they don't change their strategy or move up, become more mainstream, they'll fade out. And it was interesting. It had been 29 years since I had begun this, that we started this stuff. It was just right on time. And clearly we began to move into the mainstream from a different perspective.
Yeah, we moved into another model and another, you know, but the groundwork was laid, right? So we formed this, you know, we had this idea for the organization, and I had started to think, you know, who's going to lead this? Somebody's got to lead it. And
I had an idea there.
Well, and what's interesting was that, you know, so I had a large organization. I ran a large organization, and I had a very, a board of directors that, let's just say, as long as the organization was running well, they weren't too worried about what else I might want to do. So we had a very good run, and then this other organization I'd founded, this mission and tech organization, the mission of it was promoting a high-quality, cost-effective healthcare system, equitable, high-quality, cost-effective, equitable healthcare system. And when I told the board of directors about Intact America, they said, well, that seems to fit right in. So they took the Intact America in as a, well, they were the fiscal sponsor, which basically meant they housed Intact America, and my salary, you know, was not separate. I mean, they just kept paying my salary for whatever, you know, I was doing, and we were able to use office space, and we had contracts. It was all structured legally because they were a 501c3, and the health plan was a 501c3. It was a lot of things that came together and that worked that were kind of unique, you know, at the time to have that opportunity. And that's how we got started. And Dean funded it. And Dean put up over $1 million to start, plus what he had put in to get everything rolling. And I remember people thought what a massive amount of money that was. And I still get people who will say to me, you got $1 million. What's going on? Why is circumcision still happening? You know? So it liberated us. It did liberate us to spend to hire professionals. You know, we hire professional PR people, professional messaging, got a beautiful website to start. He continued to fund us over the, and still and continues to fund us now, not at that kind of level, but and we built, you know, we started to build a social media presence. And anyway, it's been now, what, 12, 13 years?
13 years.
And I think that what has changed the most is the environment has become, I mean, when we started, when Intact America started, you know, there might be an article a month in some publication or something online every couple of months. And now, as you know, Brendan, as you know, Marilyn knows, there's a tremendous amount of activity and conversation, and we have not slain the beast, but this is not a quirky, incidental issue. This has become a mainstream issue. And the fact that we haven't, you know, slain the circumcision beast doesn't mean that we haven't made massive changes in the public's view about the procedure. So, you know, that's where we are now. And Intact America is definitely the largest intactivist organization in that we have paid staff, paid expert consultants. We have a physical space that's an actual office, which doesn't mean nothing during COVID, but, you know, we have physical address and we have, you know, a big, huge social media presence and a platform. We sent out more than 1 million emails this year. Emails, actual, you know, obviously they many of them were the same email, but we sent out more than 1 million emails this year. We have a professional database to track our constituents, our donors. And we're engaged in a social media activity right now, digital advertising with a company that's based in the Netherlands and works to help nonprofits attract more followers. We're doing that. So we have, you know, a lot of different initiatives going on.
Marilyn, I'm curious, when you met Georgianne, what is it about her that made you think this is a person who I could trust to be a leader in the movement and eventually now merge the organization that you founded with? So I'm curious, what is it you saw in Georgianne that made you think, like, this is the person?
Her confidence, her capability. She has the insights of where we need to go. And she's really, the insights are amazing to me. And then she has a confidence within herself to know what to do to make that, whatever her insight was, whatever her vision was, to make that work. So she, that was huge. But also her compassion, her love of people. When I went to her office in New York, and we'd walk in the morning and she'd say hello to everybody. She just, without any kind of airs about her or whatever, just she's a real person, you know, her honesty, her trustworthiness. I could go on and on, but I'll start embarrassing her.
And then she kept saying to me, I apologize for getting you into this.
You know, it's also because now she's coming to a time where I was 10 years ago, what's going to happen as I age? And I just said, well, don't worry, because somehow the universe is running this show, as far as I can tell, because one thing after another has worked all the way along. And in the early days, I was always fretted about what to do next, what to do, where is the money going to come from, how am I going to do this? And again, I just flew by the seat of my pants because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just doing it. I just knew I was going to bring an end to circumcision. I thought I'd do it in 2 years. Well, that was pretty 42 years ago, you know, so, you know how clear I was on the issue. But George Ann's has always been clear, and I just felt that she, that would be great, and I trust that there'll be somebody else who will step up with just the right kind of stuff. I don't think she's done with the major part of the work that she's going to offer to this organization and the leadership that she has begun. I suspect that there's more coming in that way. But I also think that there'll be a point that somebody else will come along, and I just have to trust that, because that's how I've done it so far. I hope we don't go backwards on that. It's an important issue, and I don't think it will die. I think we'll just keep going until one day we'll win. But it sure is a hard one. My mother said to me, I said, Mom, this is taking longer. I thought I could bring an end to circumcision in 2 years. And she said, if it were boring, if it were easy, you would have gotten bored. And for 42 years, I've never gotten bored. It's a fascinating human rights issue. And the fact that it keeps going is even more fascinating.
So I'm curious now, Intact America and No Circ are merging.
What
does that mean? And you have merged already.
Right.
Okay. What does that mean, and how is it that came about?
Well, I think we always figured this was going to happen. And some of it has to do with efficiency, right? Even though Marilyn didn't have a high overhead, some of it had to do with the fact that she wanted to do some other things with her time, and she was all by herself with No Circ, and she was already our clinical consultant. But Marilyn can tell you, you know, we're both writing books at this moment, all three of us,
all three of us. Yeah.
So I have a new respect for authors and editors as well.
So you know, and Marilyn's age, and I feel that because, as she said, you know, I'm 10 years behind or 11 years behind or something, and you know, we all worry about how to spend our time as we get older and what our legacy is going to be. The other thing is that we could comfortably absorb Marilyn into Intact America and make sure that she continued to be compensated for the work that she is doing now, as well as for her legacy. And that was extremely important to me and extremely important to our Intact America's donors. And then Marilyn has a set of supporters who, you know, for them, Marilyn walks on water, and they want her to be able to continue and be, you know, and be successful and be productive. So it just made sense. There was no infrastructure at No Circ that we really had to, you know, my health plan had merged with another organization, and that was a massive 2-year undertaking to merge infrastructures. But we did not have, thankfully, we didn't have that. Really, our growing pains.
I wasn't organized enough, well enough.
No, don't say that, because that's not it. You know,
it was a different kind of an organization before you started, which is why we needed you.
It was funny because our Intact America was fortunate, in addition to having these consultants that helped us to set up the organization, we had a wonderful attorney who's like really the bomb in, you know, nonprofit world, very, very creative, very conscientious. And it turned out that that he and the attorney Marilyn had used over the years, also specializing in nonprofit mission-driven organizations and similarly brilliant, were, I think, law school friends. They knew each other. So this guy in San Francisco and our guy in New York, you know, and it's just, everything just went very smoothly. It wasn't, it was more of a spiritual merger and a marker of the movement, you know, some consolidation. I mean, which I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't somewhat more going down the line, but you know, I'm not sure about that. And anyway, that's how we're doing it. And Maryland's donors have been interested in how we're handling things, and I it's just been 100% positive.
So what does it mean practically for the organization? Because I know that No Circ had centers around the country, or people who would be, say that, oh, I'm the No Circ of this particular state. Is that...
That's an interesting...
Go ahead.
Sorry. That's an interesting point, because when I first realized that I didn't want to do nursing centers anymore, because, you know, just as I moved on and couldn't or wouldn't have time and so forth, and I also wasn't doing it as well as I thought I could have. I struggled with that for quite a few months there, wondering what to do. And it turned out the day that I was writing to everybody, actually I did, I wrote a letter to everybody and said, I'm going to disband no-circ centers. And we'll no longer be doing that. And Georgianne called me to tell me, I had clicked the send button, that message went out. Georgianne called me to tell me about your whole baby. So I immediately called Jen Williams, and I said, would you be willing to take on the no-circ centers and embrace them and use them in your organization? And she said, yes, absolutely. So I wrote a second letter to everybody to say, here's what you can do. You can join your whole baby and work through them to work locally in your own community, which of course is neat. So that turned out to be pretty good too.
That's great.
And Jen was, yeah.
So what you're really seeing is a kind of divergence, you know, between a professionally staffed organization and a grassroots organization that is staffed primarily by volunteers. My view about different organizations and different tactics is that all of it's needed, you know.
Sure.
All of it's good, all of it's needed. I mean, there are obviously some people or activities that, you know, one of us might roll our eyes, you know, at the other or whatever. But in general, if you read the social change playbook, these organizations all play a role in every movement. You know, you have so that's what we're seeing in Intact America. So it's a big relief, not a relief. That's not the right word. It's a good thing. To have organizations that are primarily focused on moms and babies, right? And that kind of grassroots communication, that grassroots model. And obviously we're in sync with that. You know, we certainly pay attention to that. We certainly have pieces that we publish or write that focus on that, but we're not primarily a one baby at a time organization. We're more big picture. That's why we do national surveys. We look at trends. I mean, it's a different thing. And
wonderful.
But it's all important, you know. Then you have the other organizations that are more confrontational. That's also part of every social change movement. And I think that if we look at the fact that this issue has become very prominent, it's because you have all of these forces operating. And, you know, one of the things about this year has been so remarkable. I mean, this year's 2021 has been incredible. I mean, you have IA's opinion poll showed that nearly one out of four Americans think that it's best to keep baby boys intact. I mean, those aren't all the people having babies. I mean, someone can think that and go to the hospital and get coerced into circumcising their son, but that's a remarkable statistic compared to when we first did that survey. And it was like 12%, and now it's about 24%. That article in The New Yorker by Gary Steingart about his botched circumcision when he was 7 years old was an unbelievably important piece, because it was published in the magazine of the intelligentsia in this country, and a lot of the readers of The New Yorker would be people who would have rejected the intactivist movement in the past. And so that was extreme, and the issue reached a whole new audience with that article. Then the fact that there were three letters published after the article, only three. The New Yorker usually publishes maybe two on a feature article, three, and one of them was from me and from Intact America, and that was an incredible. It was just, you know, it was excellent for the movement that happened, and then other things. You know, the other things. I mean, new articles keep hitting, you know, hitting us. Like there was an article that showed that 12% of all medical malpractice, pediatric surgery, medical malpractice cases are about circumcision. Just these things just keep kind of coming out. There was the study that showed that circumcision doesn't reduce HIV, the risk. In the West, that was the Journal of Urology published that. I mean, that was a breakthrough article. And then most recently, and incredibly important, is that is the founding of this group called Brukim, which is the Jewish organization that is working with mainstream synagogues and other Jewish leadership organizations to get them to be inclusive and to state that they welcome Jewish families who have intact children who want to keep their children intact. So that's, you know, we've got the medical justifications falling apart. Mainstream.
These articles that you're talking about are coming around now to exactly to illuminate the various things that we've been working on all of these years, which was, first of all, bringing everybody together, dispelling the medical myths, and then also explaining the harmful physical and emotional consequences of cutting the genitals of children. So we sort of got put all the medical stuff aside. I mean, we're not putting it aside, but we've come to the head of that, and we've covered all of those issues. And all the articles that are coming out are proving what we've been talking about for the last 40 years.
Right.
And so now we can begin to look towards the. And I think this is interesting, Brendan, the fact that I began this as a nurse because I was so horrified by what I'd witnessed in the hospital. And Georgiana, on the other hand, was in law school and was looking, studying ethics and law and ethics and looking at it from that point of view. So it's a perfect transition to go from the medical myths having been dispelled to now let's embrace and begin to look at what we're talking about in terms of children's rights.
But I think that what's really also happened is that the medical benefits discussion has all but disappeared. I mean, people are not, you don't get the same level of pushback on the medical front. People just like kind of now are going like, oh, well, but okay, but it's better. Or, oh, but it's cleaner, which they always said, but they don't bother to fight you on, you know, all the medical benefits. And that's partly because the pediatricians aren't really taking a hard line on that. They're saying, oh, well, six of one, half a dozen of the other, but, you know, Medicaid should pay for it. Andy Friedman, who was on the circumcision task force of the AAP, and that policy statement's a decade old and expired, but he published a letter, article 5 years later saying, this is never going to be decided on medical benefits. Like, poof! The medical benefits argument just disappeared. And the people who push back against us are more likely to bring up the mythical locker room or the religious arguments or, you know, whatever, you know. But it's not a medical issue. The only reason circumcision is a medical issue is because it's part of the medical industry. And because it's pushed so hard as a fee-for-service moneymaker, deeply embedded in the medical industrial complex, but not because it's a legitimate medical procedure that addresses serious healthcare issues. There's absolutely no evidence that circumcised people are healthier than intact people. None, and nobody can give you any, even the most avid promoters of circumcision can't give you any data. They just give you scare tactics. So that is a huge change, an enormous change. And I think that's what's going to, you know, we have to, Intact America's goal is to really go hard after the industry that exploits mostly mothers and babies and then the future men, and to go after that and after the solicitation because that's the problem. The problem isn't that parents are desperate to have it done. The problem isn't that intact boys, you know, are dying from urinary tract infections. The problem isn't that people can't learn how to clean a child's penis. You know, it's that the medical industry has vilified the foreskin so that they can continue to cut it off and make it part of their day-to-day business.
So we've gone through how you all met, how this started, you know, a small group of maybe 50 people. Now we have a professional organization, and like you said, there's all of these new things that are happening. What is the path from where we are now to where we might want to be in the future? Because one of the things that you mentioned is that in the first 30 years of a movement, it's okay if it's all grassroots, but at some point you need to develop a new strategy. Is there a new something that needs to develop now? Is there a different path from where we are now to the future, or is it more of the same, or what does that actually look like for you all?
Well, Marilyn, you want me to take that?
Yeah, you're.
Okay, so I think that some of what I just said is going to be informative here. What we've been told is that it's better and parents want it. And even doctors who say they don't like to do it justify it by saying parents want it. And Intact America's survey on solicitation showed that parents wanting it is not, there are some parents who want it, but they're also asked an average of 8 times if they're going to do it. So this is a hard sell. It's sort of like tobacco advertising or liquor advertising.
If people wanted it, they wouldn't need to ask 8 times.
Exactly. Right. And they wouldn't need to start asking upon the results of a sonogram that says, you know, you're having a boy at 17 weeks gestation. And every shift change asking and including the consent forms in the packet. And one of the problems, you know, that we still face is that even the people who are actively involved in the solicitation don't see themselves that way. They see that they're just kind of doing their job and, well, but, you know, I have to ask because otherwise, you know, the mom might be ready to go home and then realize that, oh my gosh, it's too late to get the baby circumcised. It's like, yeah, exactly, you know, exactly, right? I have a friend who's a midwife who told her husband who wanted her baby circumcised, we missed the circumciser and now I have to leave the hospital. You know, that was how she got out of cutting her son. We were too late. He came later than, you know, and I was already on my way out the door. And so she now has an intact 30-year-old. So that survey that we did was unbelievably significant. And we did, you know, we used Qualtrics, which is a reputable survey organization. All the academicians use it. And we couldn't afford to do 50 states. We took states in all 4 regions of the country. And we basically asked new moms, I think it was moms who had given birth in the last 2 years, if they were asked about circumcision. And the average number of asks, and 90, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but upwards of 95% were asked. The average number of asks was 8 times. And they were asked by nurses, mostly, although not entirely. And we also asked the question, if you were not asked, would you have asked to circumcise your child? And a full 40, I think it was 44% said yes. But in our survey, now this is, we're not making any representation about this. We didn't try to figure out the circumcision rate in the country, but in our survey, 75% of the women went ahead with circumcision. And 44% said if they weren't asked, they wouldn't have said yes. So that raised the probability of agreeing to a circumcision, you know, way up there, right? And so we feel that you could safely make the claim that if they weren't asked, a lot fewer women would have said, would have pursued a circumcision for their son. That wasn't the purpose of the survey, to get those statistics. The purpose of the survey was to identify the solicitation. So we need to break the back of that system that facilitates circumcision. And that includes, it's a huge conglomeration of people. So the paraprofessionals are involved, like the sonographer who has to fill out a chart that says, oh boy, yes for circumcision. The nurses and educators in the prenatal care offices, the registration clerks in the hospitals, the nurses on the floor. And one of the things that makes it a little complicated is every hospital is different, so the processes might differ. But we know a lot of the elements of it, and everybody is an accomplice, down to the person, male or female, medical student or resident or physician, or in some cases nurse practitioners, down to that last person who clamps the baby's foreskin and proceeds to cut it off. So everybody along the line is an accomplice in this, you know, and the scene of the crime in the U.S. is still overwhelmingly the hospital. Now, in countries like Canada or Australia, you're seeing where they don't, where they do it less in the hospital. In Australia, the public hospitals are not allowed to, you know, do circumcisions, offer circumcisions. So you see these private clinics being set up, and so we would have to be on the alert for that. But overwhelmingly, the scene of the assault is the American hospital. And that's what we are. We haven't described our current vision of the strategy, but that's what we're aiming to target, is everybody along the way and ultimately the hospital and the doctors, all of whom disclaim responsibility. They all say they right. only do it because somebody else told them to, or somebody else wants it, and they don't make any money off of it. None of them make any money off of it.
I'm tempted to go into some of the material I've been working on for the book that I'm finishing, because what you described is what's known in social justice as the complicity principle, meaning mm-hmm. that there's people who might not have a conscious intention
Correct.
To be a part of a social system, but they're complicit in it.
Yep.
And so it sounds like the strategy now is to get people to recognize that they are complicit in it and get them to make a different decision. Is that a sort of accurate description of the next goal?
Yes, although getting them to make a different decision, you know, yes, but how we do that, and I think that we're looking right now to really target the people who are at the end, you know, targeting parents and even targeting nurses, like floor nurses, is a weak approach. It's not going to do it. So we need to scare doctors, embarrass the hospitals, scare the hospitals. We need to make clear that even though they're, you know, I mean, people will say circumcision is illegal, it's already illegal. Well, yeah, it's technically illegal. I haven't met one single doctor who's afraid of getting put in jail for circumcising a baby. So that's just a completely ineffective thing to go around
saying.
I
think some of them might even be scared of you saying that on the podcast. That's why I was laughing a bit, because, you know, there's an incredible fragility from doctors whenever you suggest that they might be doing something wrong. Of, oh, how dare you? And, you know, you're harassing me by holding a protest
right.
that's
right.
perfectly legal and, you know, all of these.
But at the same time, so they don't like it, but at the same time, they're sleeping okay at night. They're not worried about a knock on the door of somebody and cart them off to jail, right?
They're They're cashing the check.
Yeah, and they're in a setting that protects them, right? I mean, I haven't heard of a hospital being stormed by local police or trying to cart off the circumcisers. I mean, I'd love to hear a story like that. But you know, so in fact, they are. I think the medical community just keeps hoping will go away. Right?
You know, when I was
some have explicitly said that. So,
yeah.
Yes. Marilyn, what were you going to say?
I'm sorry. When I was in nursing school, one of the things that we learned that was very, very important is before a nurse, when you take a consent form into a patient, it's very specific what you have to explain, what the procedure is, how it's performed, what the risks are, what the alternatives to it are, for example, not doing anything. And it was stressed to how important that was and how that was one of the nurse's responsibility, ultimate responsibilities. I took that very seriously. And when I started taking consent forms into parents, I would ask right away, first of all, some parent complained because she said I made her feel guilty about circumcising her baby, which I would never do as a mother of three circumcised boys. That's the last thing I would ever do to a mother. She was shocked. She wasn't the only one. Parents didn't necessarily want to hear this because we're challenging our own cultural belief systems. This is deeply ingrained in all of us. And so, but I was told to keep my mouth shut. I said, this is my responsibility, my legal obligation, my responsibility in this job. It didn't matter. They didn't care about that. Just keep your mouth shut. I was cutting into their cutting business. So I think the informed consent stuff is really important. And yet, how do you get past it when you've got these obstacles in front of you? Nobody wants to hear it. They won't believe you. And you're the odd man out. And of course, I was forced to resign because I insisted upon telling parents the truth.
But that to me is really important that healthcare workers who are in those positions hear this argument and hear these facts. But
absolutely,
it's very much tactically on the level of educating one pregnant mom at a time.
That's right.
It's just not going to, you know, that's never going.
We need cannons.
It's like stopping, you know, the 12-year-old, you know, who's heading into the school from, you know, in back of the dumpster and telling him that cigarettes are harmful to his health, you know, as he's putting a cigarette out.
Right.
I mean, it's true.
Right.
But you're not going to stop, you know, 12-year-olds from vaping with that strategy. So I think that, you know, it has to be a much bigger, broader campaign.
But how do you get hospitals or any institution like that to begin to do what they're obligated to do? Because clearly they're not now, and they're refusing to even see that they're obligated.
Well, don't get it by asking them, that's for sure.
Absolutely not. You're right. You don't go to the stakeholders.
Right.
You don't appeal to the stakeholders. They've got something in interest here.
So, we have some plans to roll out some strategies that will be designed to make doctors and hospitals very nervous.
Good.
And, you know, that's what we're working on. That's what we're working on now.
So what is the process for an organization like yours doing that? And actually, one of the questions I wanted to ask is what the difference is between a professional and grassroots organization. So, and both of you can answer this too, because Marilyn, you've obviously run a grassroots organization for a very long time. I'd also be curious to know, from your perspective, how does what Georgianne and her organization is doing look different than what the movement did for those first 30 years? So what is the difference between there?
Well, in the first 42 years, for me, the first 30 years and more, was really just starting to talk and gathering people. And of course, one of the things that I did was 15 international symposia in 29 years. So that was really, or 30 years, something like that. It was bringing together people from all over the world, because I didn't want just, and I, when Georgianne, you mentioned about getting doctors to be embarrassed or shaming them or trying to make them hold them responsible or culpable. One of the reasons I took my symposium to other countries was because I thought if when doctors from other countries start looking at us, and often they did, doctors would say to me, you'll never stop circumcision in America because it's an easy moneymaker and American doctors are too greedy. I thought that was interesting to me. But I flew by the seat of my pants and just sort of went along with what I could do, number one, to get the message out. And I did everything I could in that regard. Oh, sorry about this.
So, one of the things I remember, sorry, go ahead, Georgianne.
You go ahead. I'm curious to see what you're going to say.
Oh, I was going to say that one of the things I remember when I interviewed Marilyn for my film was that the phone was constantly going off. That the NoCirc number is her actual number, and she's constantly going with it. So, but go ahead with what you were going to say, Georgianne.
Yeah, well, I mean, another obvious difference, a very obvious difference, is a professional organization pays people, you know, so you can hire people who have expertise. And, you know, there's this sentiment among a lot of people in the grassroots nonprofit world that you should be doing this work out of the goodness of your heart and you shouldn't be making a salary. Well, that's absurd. You know, how are people, I mean, don't you want people who are professional and capable and could get other jobs to do this work, you know? I mean, I was a healthcare executive. I'm an attorney. I've got, you know, 40 years of working, you know, as a CEO in healthcare under my belt. And that, and how can you dismiss that as being worthy of compensation? We hire consultants who are experts. You know, and that doesn't mean that people who are volunteers, we have volunteers also who do awesome work and have tremendous expertise, but they got somebody else paying their salary so they can volunteer. I had an experience recently where somebody who's a consultant for Intact America was told by somebody in another organization, I didn't realize you were getting paid. I thought you were doing this work out of the goodness of your heart. And it's like, what does that mean? You know, like, how does that imply that, how can you imply that because somebody is able to eat, you know, and what you should be working, staying up all night and doing your grassroots intactivism work and then working some paid job during the day. So Intact America's paid. I mean, I was never separately compensated. I was fortunate enough to have an organization that paid me a decent salary. And that's going to change, you know, over the next couple of years as I probably retire from my other work. But, you know, we hire people, we pay them a competitive salary. We can demand that they have particular skills. Some volunteers have a lot of time and are extremely, you know, I was going to say disciplined, but that's not right. You know, they have the time to put in the serious amount of work, but many volunteers are trying to fit this in between other demands in their lives, children and paid jobs. And so you have to have professional people working if you're going to make a difference. If you look at any of the successful human rights movements and organizations. Now, some of them maybe are bloated. I don't know, but you know, they all have staff. They have paid staff. They have press spokespeople. They have people writing their press releases. I mean, you know, compare a press release written by a professional PR person with one written by someone who, you know, never did that before, and you'd have a pretty easy time picking out which was which, and you'd have a pretty easy time knowing which one was going to get published. So that's a huge difference.
One thing I wanted to ask about was, since you have professional staff, what is your hiring process for them? Because
we don't have a lot of staff, right?
Sure.
Basically, I mean, we don't have a lot, but we use a lot of consultants, and our hiring process is easier said than done. They got to get the issue, right?
Right.
They've got to get the issue. And that is not really that easy. So we're working with a PR firm that I've now known for 20 years, and they get the issue. And at least the people who we work with directly, you know, get it. We found ourselves educating the consultants over and over in since we were founded, because even people who are sympathetic to the cause often don't understand the complexity of it. They have bought into some of the common wisdom, the common stupidity about the issue, you know, that it is healthier, or, well, you know, it's a religious thing, or, you know, whatever it is. And we have very seriously thought through position statements on these issues. Or they'll come in and they'll say, well, why don't you hook this, you know, why don't you link your issue to something more popular, and then you'll get more traction. It's like, that ain't happening, right? So those kinds of things, all very well-meaning. But we actually have had consultants who responded to requests to talk to us, and then were actually angry at when they understood what we were doing. So that's number one, right?
Right.
Number one should be the skills. So we're already talking to people who we believe have the skills. And then there's the comprehension of the issue. And then, you know, it's just like hiring anybody. It's like finding yourself a good doctor, or finding yourself a good lawyer, or finding yourself a good tutor for your child. Whatever it is, you know, you just vet people's credentials and how they perform for you. And the good thing about using consultants is that we're not locked into, you know, permanent salaries, because I don't hire somebody and put them on payroll if I'm worried that I'm not going to have the money in a year to pay them. I don't want to hire people and lay them off. Marilyn and I have a thing here. Marilyn has thought in the past that Intact America was too aggressive in our fundraising. And, you know, I always go back to the church. You know, why do they pass the collection plate five times? They pass the collection plate five times because people give money and they need the money to, you know, if you don't like what the church does, you don't have to give them money. But, you know, that's how organizations raise money, is by asking. And Marilyn said, well, I always just thought the universe would provide. I would just always say the universe would provide. And I say, would you like me to tell Steven Patterson that on payday? You know, Steven's our director of communications, and he, you know, he has to pay rent on his apartment, and he's getting married in a few months, and, you know, I'm sure he'll want to have a child, and he has a dog to feed. And am I going to tell him, you know, sorry, you know, you're going to have to talk to the universe about paying the rent? So, you know, we're very careful not to add people, even as consultants, if we think that we're not going to have the money to pay them. So that's, you know, but finding people who understand the issue is still not at all easy, and that won't surprise any Intactivist. You know, they know that.
I asked about that in part because I've realized in my own work that hiring is a skill, and it's one that I've had to get better at over time.
Yes.
And for many of the reasons that you mentioned, that you have to find someone who gets the thing that you're working on and is good at their job. And it sounds like what you often do is you're hiring people for a specific task. So you've determined this is the area we need to work on, and for that we need a lawyer, we need a consultant, right, we need a polling firm.
Or people with that someone. Expertise, right. Right.
Right.
So I hired a director of philanthropy this past year who, terribly unfortunately, is ill now and is not able to work. And I advertised on Indeed for that. Now, don't forget, I've been running organizations since I was 35, right? So that's 35 years. So, and before that, I was a manager. So I've been hiring people and training them for most of my life. So I advertised on Indeed. I had a really good job description, and I said that any person who applicants had to tell me why they the issue resonated with them. I don't remember the language I used, but they needed to do that. They needed to say why they wanted to work for Intact America, you know, and our issue. And they needed to send a cover letter. And I got more than 150 applications. And out of the 150, there were probably a dozen cover letters. The rest didn't have cover letters. And only two people said why, three, because one was not really a real job applicant, but he was a consultant. Three people out of the 150 had apparently bothered to look up Intact America and see what our mission was, find out my name, and write about why they were moved to apply for this job. And almost everybody, let's say a good half of the people definitely had skills that were respondent to the position. It wasn't like I was getting, you know, people who were, you know, who had no related professional experience. I was getting people with skills and a history as fundraisers or as, you know, good administrators, you know, but only three of them addressed our issue.
That doesn't surprise me, considering what I've seen from online job applications. I think that might be just an unfortunate thing about the way that people apply online, and then also the way their application gets treated online.
Right, right. But, you know, I had the word out, so anyway, and I was fortunate. I found a really wonderful person, and unfortunately now she's ill, so I'm not sure whether she's going to be available to work for us. So if anybody is listening to this podcast and has the skills to be a professional, you know, we call it director of philanthropy, director of fundraising, and the database experience, the organizational experience, supervisory experience, you know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was actually one of the things I was going to ask, is if someone wanted to work for Intact America, what the process for that would be. And it sounds like that they need to reach out, they need to show that they care about the issue, that they have the skills to do the job. Is there anything else that I'm missing or that
right now we don't have any job openings. You know, we just, except possibly we'll be filling the director of philanthropy job if the person who's in this position is not able to come back. But there are other kinds of projects. And unfortunately, you know, for all my talk about us being a professional organization that pays salaries, we're still not robust enough to hire. If I had the budget, I could very productively put another, you know, half a dozen people to work this year, but we don't have a budget for it. But people write to me, you know, all the time, and sometimes we're able to use them for a writing project, or we still rely a lot on volunteers, but we do have some paid staff.
It makes sense to hire a director of philanthropy first, because before you can hire more people, you have to have the money to hire more people.
Exactly.
So I'm curious what the process is there, because I know that it's been more resources is the desire of any organization trying to grow, but also for activist organizations, I know for a long time people have been wanting there to be more resources in the movement, wanting some sort of significant funder or more significant funders of some kind. So I'm curious what the strategy is there, or
you know,
what sort
it's
of stuff
just,
you're thinking around that.
I think that we have what we have in common with other nonprofit organizations trying to raise money is that it's a long process, you know, and it's about you know, who you know, who your donors know. What has made it, I think, difficult for intactivist organizations is the stigma attached to our issue. And the fact also that historically, the people who are really passionate about this movement, you know, they're not like mainstream people, right? A lot of us are kind of out of the box thinkers, and now there are wealthy people who are out of the box thinkers, and you know, we fortunately, you know, had one who helped us to get going. We had another wonderful donor who passed away last year, the beginning of 2020, and left us a considerable amount of money, and he was a man who this had been something that had concerned him his whole life, and he had, you know, saved a lot of money, and when he found out he was dying, he gave it to us, and that was, you know, it's an awesome responsibility to get a donation like that from somebody, but a lot of times our donors, even the ones that are, you know, relatively, you know, give us relatively large, when they say, you know, who do you know? Who can you talk to? Who can you steer it? Well, I don't talk about this issue. You know, I don't talk to my family about it. I don't talk to my friends about it. I'm the only person I know who cares about this issue. Now, I think what people are finding out is that's not necessarily true. Sometimes, you know, we've had a lot of stories now where, gee, I thought I couldn't talk to anybody, and it turns out my next door neighbor also supports you, you know, or supports another activist organization. But it's just a long process. And what we are missing is that, you know, I was on a hospital board of directors where all the board members sit around and try and outdo each other with how much money they're going to give to the hospital. But they're all rich guys, mostly, all rich guys. I'll just say a couple of interesting things. You might be interested in this. Most of our donors, the vast majority of our donors are male. The almost all of our higher level donors are male. We do have a lot of women who donate at more modest amounts, and that to me shows who feels most seriously impacted by this issue. You know, our typical donor would be a man between the ages of, say, 35 and 80.
It could also be an indicator of who has money, because
absolutely. That's part of it, right? But women have money too, right? And there are women philanthropists. I mean, for example, on a hospital board, you will have in a hospital or other kind of social service organizations, adoption agents, you will get women donors, you know, wealthy women donors. We don't see that. So it's a combination, clearly, you know. But our donors who scrape the bottom of their bank accounts to give us money are almost all male.
Interesting.
And, yeah, it's extremely interesting. And you know, of course, what we welcome support from anybody, but what we hear from our donors over and over is, and I tell people this who are embarrassed to ask for money, say, we hear from our donors, thank you for being there, because you being there means that I can count on this work getting done. And it means that I don't have to do this work. You know, I wouldn't be good at this work. I can work my job. I mean, Dean Pisani, who was our founding donor, you know, he says to me, you're doing the work. I just write the check. Now, you know, that's awesome, you know, way of looking at it, because he can write the check and we can do the work. But that we hear that from so many people who support us. And I'm sure that's true of all nonprofit.
One thing I wanted to ask about that you mentioned was the stigma that sometimes exists, at least in the minds of certain people around this issue. I know that as there have been more media articles about the issue, there've also been a few more hit pieces or attacks on the movement at the same time. And so I'm curious if there is a strategy or way that you're thinking about handling that or responding to that in the future, or simply focusing on something else instead.
I don't worry too much about what anybody says negative about our organization. I mean, if they were saying they were accusing me of stealing money, you know, then I might have to, you know. But there are no arguments against intact. I mean, there's no argument in favor of circumcision that has any persuasive value at all. So anything that anyone would say about that, you know, I don't feel the need to address, except, you know, in our materials and our position statements or whatever. No, I mean, I think that there is not much organized opposition to our movement. There's no overt organized opposition. The organized opposition to our movement is the medical industrial system, right? The medical industrial complex. They are, and they're not doing it to oppose our movement. It's just that their practices are getting in the way of our success. So we have to attack their practices. But no, we don't. I mean, I get, you know, all kinds of emails from people telling me I'm full of it. You know, I don't feel the need to respond.
In the early years, I had death threats.
Just a waste of time.
But not so much anymore.
I don't think that's sort of, you sure did.
And the other thing that I found in terms of donors was often it was men who'd been hurt. One in particular, a large donor I had that helped me in the early years with my symposium and so forth, had been circumcised, and it was a botched circumcision. He never talked about it, never told anybody. But this is a way that he could fight it and see that something was being done to stop it. And then in terms of the men who defend it, what's happening, is that they're the ones who can't admit in truth what happened to them. And they don't want to know that they've got how embarrassing to say, oh, I've got a damaged penis, I've got damaged goods. This is man's organ of procreation and you know, so forth. It's masculinity. It's all, and for a man who's been deeply wounded by circumcision, then he may not be able to accept the fact that he's been wounded. He's going to fight that fact and say there's nothing wrong with him.
You know, I'm so glad Marilyn said that because, you know, I can't tell you, and she, you know, for all the years she worked before and the years I've been working on, I can't tell you how many people have said to me, you're the first person I ever said this to, or you're the first person I ever told about my botched circumcision. You're the first person. And I'm sure this was a parallel with gay rights organizations, you know, that this is the coming out. And I would say the last 10 years have been a massive coming out on this issue. And without that, we will never prevail. So, you know, when somebody says, well, I never heard anybody complain, it's like, well, you know, let me just give you a list of about, you know, 50,000 people
who are complaining, right? And the American doctors that said, oh, I've never heard anybody complain. And suddenly there's all these seven men standing out in front of the New Orleans Convention Center with their the white costumes and the blood spatters, spot over their genitals, standing saying, "This, I am hurt, and this ends with us." That was huge, I thought. I almost fell to my knees when I saw them.
Yeah, so that kind of speaking out and giving people an opportunity, and that goes from the, you know, what the demonstration level, which is what Marilyn just referred to, down to the very private individual level that, you know, I can have lunch with somebody and then they can say something to me and say, you know, and often it's coupled with something else, that, from the individual to the, you know, larger level, all the things that go on a personal level and then, you know, magnified, you know, up to an organization or a movement, right? It's like Marlo Guthrie in the Alice's Restaurant song, you know, you got one person saying something and then but you got three people, you know, it's a movement, right? Like, and then also opening the doors for people to talk to each other, right? Like, I've had, unfortunately, I can't do this right now with COVID, but I was in San Francisco right at the beginning of, right before the COVID pandemic, and I invited, three donors to dinner. I mean, you're talking, you know, at a quasi, you know, fast food place. I mean, very informal dinner. And they, you know, talked to each other, and neither one of them had ever talked to anyone about the issue. But the fact, and I told them that there might be other people at the dinner, and two showed up and then a third later and didn't join in much because he was in a hurry. But, you know, so they met each other, which was far more important than them meeting me. And then I know they've, you know, seen each other since then just to talk. And on a large level, you know, that's what a social movement does. It helps people find their place I think that the LGBTQ movement is probably a good analogy, you know, for that. And, you know, I told, you know, Harvey Milk, the movie Milk is, you know, my inspiration. I watch it probably 3 times a year. You know, it's my favorite. It's my favorite because he said, you know, if you can't talk about it, you know, he said to people, you got to get up and you got to go tell your mother, you got to tell your brother, you got to tell your neighbor, you got to tell everybody. Because otherwise, okay, they're just going to, you know, they can shame you. You know, they think, they say, I never.
That's exactly how the movement started.
Exactly. Exactly.
My big mouth, it never stopped.
Well, all the people who said to you that were willing to come out, right?
You know, I've always been amazed by how many people were willing to lend their voice. Each of those symposiums that we did, 15 symposiums, and all of these professionals internationally, people got up and stood up and joined the movement by lending their voice and never asking for money or getting paid. And that was, it just seemed to me it was really, those were the early days. And anyway.
Yeah, we still find people, you know, who hark back to those days. You know, I'll have a conversation with someone who will say, oh, yeah, you know, Our Bodies, Ourselves, which was the women's health movement that started in the 60s.
Right.
And, you know, I've talked to people over the years and said, why didn't they ever deal with circumcision? And say they'll have anecdotes. Oh, Ed Wallerstein begged us to deal with it. There are boxes in the archives at Harvard School of Public Health or about the arguments that people had about this issue, and it'll go back.
Right.
Memory is long on this. This issue has plagued people for decades.
Yeah.
Relatively so few people have had the whatever. I mean, I would say courage. Maybe it's another word to speak out. I think one thing Marilyn and I have in common is we never felt like we needed courage. We
were driven.
You have to say it.
Brendan, when I heard you say about writing your book, you were driven. That's exactly it. There was never, even when I was at work, I always knew that I was right. And no matter what anybody said, nobody could have stopped me because I just knew what was happening was too wrong. And if nobody else was doing it, I was going to. I had to do it. I couldn't not do it. I think you feel the same way, Georgiana.
Yeah.
I passed the torch and passed your heart.
I mean, and that's I'm sure true of all of the Intactivist leaders. You know, they are 100% unable. I was gonna say unable to not do this work. You know, you can't not
exactly.
do this work.
Yeah. You can't not do it. That's exactly right.
The other thing, going back to, you know, you're asking questions about fundraising, you're talking about money, is I had an epiphany fairly recently, the last couple of years, when I read, you know, after same-sex marriage, you know, became established, and I use that as an example of how you get a tipping point. And we had just gotten this, you know, this legacy gift, in the, you know, amount of a couple of $1 million, $3.5 million, which seemed like so astonishing to me. And I read an article from Rolling Stone magazine about the LGBTQ, no, about the same-sex marriage movement. And this one guy named Tim Gill gave $450 million to the movement, right? So, and he wasn't the only donor, right?
right?
That was just this one guy. So, this is work that takes an immense amount of, it doesn't happen on its merits. We could be right all we want, but, you know, organizing and really, you know, putting a tremendous amount of effort into it. You would ask about what a professional organization does. I mean, you know, that's what we need. And then there is evolution of that. I mean, sometimes the professional organizations get, I remember when Gay Men's Health Crisis got accused of, you know, wasting money and whatever. But what they had done was astonishing, to get to the point that they did. They essentially destigmatized, not totally, but, you know, HIV, right? And so anyway, it's really important that we look at ourselves as a mainstream movement, mainstream social justice movement. And as
one of the things I helped Georgia with that is our ability, and particularly as women, to talk about men's penises, to not be shy, to talk about that part of the body that nobody else is talking about, but we can talk about it wholesomely and with confidence and without making any, relieving people of their own anxieties and shyness and so forth, because we are comfortable. And that makes a huge difference, I think.
Yeah, that shouldn't be an issue, but it is, you know. We still live in a pretty prudish culture, right? I mean, I'm so in...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We couldn't even talk about penises until Lorena Bobbitt cut off her husband's penis, and then you could say penis. We can't talk about the rights of children, or we can't talk about circumcision, and yet you can do this to a baby. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how we're silenced. In the face of horrific things happening to infants and children, the need to silence us, as opposed to standing up with us and saying, "Yeah, that's the right way to go." To me, it just points out how deeply indoctrination occurs and remains within us, and particularly when you're affected by it, you know, that then you uphold that the parents wanting to have the right to spank their children or cut off part of the baby's body or whatever. Another thing, I have to just air this because I've been thinking about it a lot in the last few days. It's the woman who called me and said, "Well, my husband really wants my baby to be, I don't want it, but he does." And when we talk about empowering women, we know that it's a woman's job to protect her baby, that to make sure that baby's first developmental task of establishing trust is securely fastened, and yet mothers turn their babies over to the circumciser's platter. There's something horribly wrong there. So and for me, when I think about the men coming home from the wars and they've got a foot missing, a foot or an arm, a leg or an eye or an ear or whatever, and then they have a baby and they say, "Oh, I want him to match me," and they cut off a part of his penis. The rest of the body they leave intact, but why is it we get to the genitals and lose our ability to be reasonable? So there's that. And the other thing in terms of women, it occurs to me, is that women need to understand that it is their job. And how do we empower them and not let them fall into that? You don't let a wounded man wound his son to look like him. You protect your baby and do what you can to help your husband heal from his wound. It seems so simple, and yet it seems like the most difficult thing that we're doing. Hello?
Yeah.
We were thinking about what you said. Georgianne, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, you know, I think that on another level, and by the way, I would like to talk to you about your book project at some point, maybe just
sure.
You know, another time. But,
so my audience knows, they haven't read it yet. Don't cancel them for all of the statements right. that I make.
We're not complying with your program.
What I was going to say following Marilyn is that, you know, we talked about the hospitals, the medical industrial complex, and I actually believe that it's as much about disempowering women
exactly.
as it is about cutting babies. I think the babies are ancillary damage. I think that, you know, the medical system lays claim to people's bodies, but all people, anybody they can get their hands on, anybody who has an insurance card or a Medicaid card, anybody who has a limb or an organ that a medical student needs to practice on. I mean, I think that is the true evil underlying the circumcision obsession in this country.
And the disempowering of women is hugely important here. But for me, to recognize that the first victim in a patriarchal society, which that does disempower women, because it does, the baby is the victim. I mean, why he's victimized is to continue that you've done what you've needed to do to continue a patriarchal society by torturing and mutilating a baby in the beginning of life. You've disempowered him and his mother at the same time. And both of them add to the power structure.
Georgianne, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think that we've said a lot. And I really appreciate the chance to talk through all this stuff. It's always more than like an interview, you know, Brendan, when we talk, because you're so thoughtful yourself and you have so much, you know, you have so much deep knowledge about this. And those of us who are, you know, who live this, you know, all day, every day, don't always get the chance to talk to people who we talk to each other and you're both in the world and also brokering, you know, with the outside world, and that's really great. So, you know, I think it's been a great conversation. I want to thank you.
Well, you know, Marilyn, you said, oh, you can take this out. We're just thinking out loud. That's all that the podcast is. We're just thinking out loud. Sometimes the best moments come from thinking out loud. And they're actually, they've done research. Very often people's, you know, eureka moments are not when they're alone, but they're when they're in conversation and two ideas come together or two people come together. To take it full circle, the organization that exists now, which, by the way, is the name changing or is it still Intact America?
No, Intact America.
Still Intact America. But the organization that exists now is the result of two organizations coming together. And in fact, Intact America is in some way the result of the two of you and several other people coming together.
And others. I mean, you know, ARC was at the table. Doc was at the table. ICGI, which was Dan Ballinger. Lots of Intactivists. I mean, we had an incredibly rich group of thinkers at the table when we formed Intact America, and everybody participated. Everybody, and the thing that was the most, you know, astonishing to me was that everybody came together and very collaboratively endorsed what had happened.
We were all proud of what had happened.
And I was fully prepared to have somebody, I mean, I was one of the newest people, you know, I was fully prepared to have somebody else go, you know, this is mine, you know.
Not in my mind, you weren't.
Well, you know, I want to do this. I mean, I think but it became clear that I had, you know, the experience and the
qualified
and the infrastructure. You know, I had both of those things. Everybody else was really working grassroots, you know, out of their own living room, basically. And that's great. That's what needed to be done for the first decades. But we got the point, and that's
for the first 30 years.
Yeah, and that's what Dean recognized. He recognized it was time to do something different.
Yeah, bigger, and to take it to the next level. And you did it, honey. You did it.
So I recorded my first 4-hour podcast recently, and I'm certain combined group here could talk that long. But I also get the impression that we don't necessarily want to talk that long today.
I think we're good.
Right. So with that in mind,
I have to go let the dog out of the room. I locked him in. Right.
So, I did want to hear about your book, Brendan.
That's a whole other conversation.
I hear.
At least 100,000 words.
I'm very much. More important than that, I'm looking forward to reading it because I think you'll have a lot to add to the conversation in that regard.
I would like to encourage people who are listening to this podcast, if you haven't already, to go to the Intact America website, to sign up on social media for all the Intactivist organizations. It always shocks me to have somebody call me and say, I want to know more about the movement. What can you tell me? And it's like, are you on social media? Do you have Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and you go to the website? Oh no, you know, I don't do that. It's like, oh, well then, you know, I can't help you. Right. So go online, find out about the issue, find out about Intact America, sign up for our newsletter. You will get letters asking you to donate. If you don't want to donate, you just don't donate. You don't want to say that to people. You don't have to donate. If you feel inspired to reach out, to send your story, whatever, but do engage with the content of the organizations that you're looking at, because we are all a little different. We all have slightly different approaches, and it's what makes this movement so super rich and interesting. So I'd like to encourage people who are listening to this to do that, to reach out. And obviously to go back and watch American Circumcision if they haven't already. I think that's a gift that keeps on giving.
It does. Indeed,
every now and then I have a follower who says they haven't seen it. And I'm like, how did you find me?
Right.
Yes, please watch it.
Right. So
I show it every time I can.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else to the two of you want to add before we finish up? Besides, go to Intact America, check out their stuff, follow them on all the places.
And now, by now, Brendan, do you know why I was enthralled with Georgianne and why I would want her to?
I've known for a while. It's not like this isn't news.
I'm sure there are plenty of people who would beg to differ, and that's fine. But yeah, we all are doing good work, and you know, I think it's great. Look, I mean, we got our podcast guy who's like awesome and making movies and writing books. I mean, and he's like interested in our issue. Like, what more could we want?
It's very flattering. Yeah.
Media, really. So. Right. And you have a beautiful baby and a beautiful wife. So hey, you know, it's all
indeed.
It's all just
indeed.
Moving.
Yeah, beautiful eyes too.
Moving right along, you know.
Life is good.
Yeah. Indeed.
Right. All right. Well,
thank you.
For coming on.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan Marotta Show. If you liked this episode, please share it with someone else who would also like it, and then go on whatever platform you listen to the show on and leave a positive review. If you want to support the show directly, go to brendanmarotta.com/show and subscribe there. Paid subscribers get special unreleased bonus material and live events that are only available to them. Once again, that is brendanmarotta.com/show. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all later.